Welcome to The Deep Dive, the shortcut you need to be truly well-informed. I'm Joe Cunningham.
And I'm Lee Meacham. We've just spent some serious time digging into our source material for today.
That's right. We're talking about Newsweek USA for the week of October 24th, 2025.
And our goal today is really synthesis, isn't it? Pulling out the key insights.
Absolutely. We're trying to connect the dots on stories covering, well, everything from nuclear threats and drone warfare right on NATO's doorstep.
To the economic ripple effects of U.S. immigration policy and even some fascinating cultural and commercial shifts.
It's quite a range. Our mission is to give you that shortcut, that deep understanding, without you having to read the whole issue cover to cover.
Yeah, the world these articles paint is definitely one of, let's say, high tension and rapid change, especially technological change.
We're jumping from these really complex peace deals brokered by the U.S.
straight into domestic unrest, and then, bam, a critical look at military readiness, or maybe unreadiness, for modern threats.
So we need to cover a lot of ground, but do it thoroughly. Let's dive in.
Where should we start? Maybe the international flashpoints. The In Focus section seems like a good place.
Agreed. Let's start with what looks like a moment of maybe fragile peace. Tel Aviv, Israel. There was a major U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement on October 13th.
Yeah, this was huge, a really massive diplomatic effort, mainly because, well, it centered on exchanging people, captives, remains, incredibly sensitive stuff.
The headline achievement seems to be the release of the final 20 living Israeli captives. They'd been held in Gaza for, what, 2 years?
Two incredibly long years. So securing their release was, you know, the immediate tangible win from these talks.
And there was another crucial piece for the families involved, right? The return of remains.
Exactly. The agreement included returning the bodies of up to 28 hostages who had died while captive. That's something that often gets lost in the big headlines, but it's so vital for humanitarian reasons and, frankly, for the politics back home.
Absolutely vital. And on the other side?
Well, the deal involved freeing nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. That number, 2,000, it really underscores the scale of the exchange, the political weight on both sides.
Immense pressure, I imagine. It took President Trump visiting the region personally to kind of seal the deal, didn't it?
It did. His visit marked the finalization, and it really highlights how much top-level involvement was needed. Probably shows how close it came to falling apart without that final push.
Such a delicate balance achieved there, which makes the contrast with what was happening elsewhere even starker. Let's pivot to Antananarivo. Madagascar. Political unrest boiling over.
Yeah, a completely different picture. And it started, interestingly, not with some big ideology clash, but with basic services failing.
Water and power supplies, right?
Yeah.
The protests that kicked off around October 9th were led by Gen Z, initially just frustrated about essentials.
Precisely. And you see how quickly that can spiral. When the government can't deliver the basics, that public anger sharpens fast.
And it escalated almost immediately, didn't it? From utility protests to broader calls for reform, and then demands for President Rajoelina himself to resign.
It's that classic pattern, isn't it? A logistical failure becomes a full-blown crisis of leadership.
And tragically, it wasn't peaceful. The UN reported, what, 22 deaths?
22 people dead in the unrest. And by October 13th, the situation was just chaos. The government itself had reported an attempted coup earlier.
But then the opposition was claiming the president had actually fled the country.
Right. Total confusion, conflicting stories at the highest level. It just shows a government that's lost control of the narrative, maybe even the state itself.
That breakdown where nobody knows who's in charge or even where the leader is, it's a disturbing parallel in a way.
Yeah.
To some domestic tensions back in the U.S. Portland, Oregon, for example.
Oh, so?
Well, not a government collapse, obviously, but a clash of authorities. Federal versus local power, centered around an ICE facility.
Ah, okay. The protest on October 7th. The sources mentioned some interesting details there, like demonstrators wearing tactical vests, some painted with the Puerto Rican flag and a heart.
Right. Which suggests maybe the protest wasn't just about immigration, but pulling in broader themes of, you know, identity resistance made it more complex.
And this gathering became a real flashpoint. President Trump called Portland war ravaged.
And moved to send in the National Guard, using federal force for a local issue.
Which, of course, triggered the courts. A federal judge stepped in pretty quickly and put a temporary block on that deployment.
That's the system working, I suppose. Checks and balances. Highlighting that separation of powers, preventing the executive just sending in troops domestically without clear cause.
And the local reaction.
Portland's mayor, Keith Wilson, called the federal officers' actions deeply disturbing. So the tension wasn't just about immigration policy itself, but about who controls the streets, who has the authority. Federal power versus local control.
It's like a microcosm of those bigger ideological fights happening across the country. It really forces you to ask, you know, when does federal intervention, even if responding to unrest, become an overreach that actually makes things less stable locally?
Exactly. Which brings us, neatly actually, to the idea of military involvement on a larger scale. Let's transition from that localized deployment question to a huge international defense issue.
Yeah.
NATO's drone defense gap.
Okay. And this part of the source material is, frankly, quite alarming. We're talking about a serious wave of drone incursions into NATO airspace. Oh. Experts are calling them some of the most serious violations in the alliance's history.
This isn't just theory, then. It's happening now.
Right now. An operational crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the expert consensus is blunt. Keir Giles from Chatham House, he didn't pull any punches, said NATO's been caught with their pants down.
Wow. Strong words.
Very. He warned they're really struggling to adapt to this kind of modern warfare, especially thinking about a sustained campaign from someone like Russia.
And the problem is partly systemic, isn't it? The speed of the alliance.
That's what Giles pointed out. NATO moves at the speed of NATO, which means slow. You have 32 members, and they don't all seem to share the same sense of urgency about this specific threat. So the response is fragmented, delayed, underfunded sometimes.
And you see that fragmentation really clearly with Poland, according to the sources.
Absolutely. Poland spent billions on rearming, right? But mostly gearing up for a traditional land war. Giles found it doubly surprising that even with all that spending and being right next door to the war in Ukraine,
they didn't have a relevant drone defense system, one that could handle these cheap, small, swarming drones.
Exactly. A massive blind spot in their threat assessment, apparently.
To really get why it's such a gap, you have to understand how the drones themselves have changed, right?
Totally. We're not just talking about the big, expensive U.S. Predators or Reapers from the War on Terror era anymore. Now it's about smaller, cheaper, mass-produced, much more maneuverable drones.
And the traditional defenses radars, missiles designed for jets or cruise missiles, they just aren't built for that.
They're fundamentally mismatched. They struggle to track, let alone shoot down, potentially hundreds of small, low-flying objects coming at them all at once.
But we should have seen this coming, shouldn't we? The sources mentioned precedents.
Oh, definitely. The 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh War was a huge wake-up call. Azerbaijan basically overwhelmed Armenia using drone fleets. Even before that, you had groups like ISIS strapping explosives onto commercial drones in Iraq and Syria. The warnings were there for years.
Yet preparedness lagged, and it came to a head recently.
Very recently. Poland reported this huge swarm of drones crossing from the direction of Belarus and Ukraine. Now, Moscow denies involvement, of course.
Which is classic hybrid warfare, the deniability aspect.
Precisely. But the suspicion is strong. And the chaos spread.
Right. Disruptions at airports in Denmark and Norway followed?
Yeah, reports of drone activity shut down major airports. It suggests a pattern, maybe not aimed at direct destruction, but definitely designed to cause panic test response times across different NATO countries.
Did they figure out what kind of drones they were?
Forensics on the ones recovered in Poland pointed towards similarities with Russia's Gerbera model. And this is interesting. The Gerbera is apparently a simpler, cheaper version of the Juran drone.
And the Juran is?
The Juran is Russia's version of Iran's Shahid drone, the infamous suicide drone. It just shows how these effective, deniable weapon designs proliferate globally now.
So Poland felt threatened enough to act.
They did. Warsaw triggered Article 4 consultations within NATO. Denmark was considering it, too.
Okay, remind us Article 4 versus the famous Article 5. What's the difference?
So Article 4 is basically a member saying, hey, we feel our security or independence is threatened. Let's talk. It's serious, shows real concern, but it's not Article 5.
Article 5 being the attack on one is an attack on all clause. The one that mandates collective defense.
And exactly. So by using these drones in this ambiguous gray zone, the adversary forces NATO to react at the Article 4 level, showing they're worried, but avoids giving them the clear justification for an all-out Article 5 military response. It's walking a very fine line.
And the timing wasn't accidental, was it? These consultations happened right alongside those big Russia-Belarus ZAPAD 2025 military drills.
Almost certainly coordinated. That combination diplomatic crisis plus massive military exercises next door applies maximum pressure.
Which brings us to that hybrid warfare strategy. James Patton Rogers called these drones the perfect gray zone weapon.
He did. His analysis is that Russia uses them to harass and test NATO, poke the defenses, see how quickly they react, where the gaps are. They're cheap, small, deniable, and hard to stop.
Operating right up to that Article 5 threshold, but deliberately not crossing it, Roger said NATO is alert but still playing catch-up.
Yeah, because the defenses are still fragmented. But there might have been an unintended consequence for Moscow here. Roger suggests these incidents might have actually pushed President Trump towards taking a tougher line on the Kremlin. The sources mention him saying Ukraine could potentially win back all its territory seized by Russia. That's a shift from previous talk about maybe needing concessions.
So the harassment might have hardened the U.S. position instead of softening it. Interesting.
Potentially, yes. And finally, there's the sheer cost and chaos factor. Daniel Byman at Georgetown pointed out the basic economic problem.
The drones are cheap to send up,
but incredibly expensive for sophisticated Western militaries to shoot down. You're using multi-million dollar missiles against something that might cost a few thousand dollars.
That's a losing economic battle.
And Sandor Fabian from NATO Special Ops HQ adds another layer. He suggests maybe we shouldn't always assume a grand, perfectly planned military objective behind every Russian action.
What's the alternative?
Sometimes the goal might just be chaos, sowing panic, discord. Fabian says they might just like to create chaos and manage results as things unfold. The psychological impact, disrupting airports, scaring people, that could be the win itself.
Wow. Just creating chaos cheaply as a strategic goal. That's chilling. Okay, let's pivot from that immediate, messy, gray zone conflict to the ultimate threat. The nuclear question, deterrence, humanity, the whole terrifying picture.
And here our sources bring in Kathryn Bigelow, the Oscar-winning director. She has a new film coming out, A House of Dynamite.
And her motivation seems to be tackling what she calls cultural amnesia about nuclear weapons.
Yeah, she feels the public conversation has just drifted off, that these world-ending weapons have been sort of been normalized, which she finds, understandably, a pretty terrifying idea.
The numbers certainly haven't gone away. Over 12,000 warheads globally.
And crucially, only 3 of the 9 nuclear powers are actually in NATO. The vast majority of that firepower sits outside the alliance's mutual defense structure.
So the film tries to shake people awake. How does it do that?
Through its structure. It's a political thriller, but it unfolds in real time over just 18 minutes.
18 minutes. Why that specific time?
That's the estimated window. From the moment an incoming nuclear ICBM launch is detected to the moment it would hit North America. 18 minutes for an impossible decision. They want the audience to feel that pressure cooker.
Intense. And they made a key narrative choice, right? About the attacker.
A really important one. Bigelow and the screenwriter, Noah Oppenheim, deliberately chose not to identify which country launched the missile.
Why?
Because they didn't want it to be easy. Oppenheim said giving the audience one clear villain would be a cop-out. They wanted the focus squarely on the system itself, the terrifying fragility of command and control, regardless of who the enemy is.
That focus on the system extends to how they portray the U.S. president in the film.
Yes, he's shown as a best-case scenario, smart, well-intentioned, serious. The point being, even the best possible leader is basically trapped by this system of sole authority for launching nuclear weapons. The system itself creates an impossible situation under that kind of time pressure.
And the research for the film uncovered something truly shocking about the real world.
Yeah, this is staggering. Bigelow and Oppenheim were genuinely horrified to learn that the actual U.S. president, a civilian, gets almost no practice for this nightmare scenario. Maybe one briefing when they take office, that's it.
Seriously, the person with the sole authority in the world barely rehearses it.
Retired LTN General Daniel Karbler, who advised on the film, confirmed it. It's perhaps the most terrifying detail. The person with the ultimate power has the least preparation for using it.
Wow. So the film aims for realism, then?
Impeccable realism on the military procedures, thanks to advisors like Karbler. But Bigelow also made sure to keep the human element fragile and central. She talked about a scene where Rebecca Ferguson's character, Captain Olivia Walker, finds a tiny toy dinosaur in her pocket during the countdown.
A toy dinosaur.
Yeah, like a little emotional anchor amidst the lethal technology. Bigelow called it a note of extinction, reminding everyone what's really at stake.
From that fictional warning, let's go to the real thing. Naveed Jamali's project, Getting Inside America's Actual Nuclear Triad.
This was unprecedented access. Jamali is the first journalist ever allowed to film all 3 legs. The bombers, the land-based missiles, and the submarines.
An incredible undertaking.
Yeah.
How did he do it?
It took months, multiple missions. Started in early 2023 with the B-52 bombers, the airborne leg. Then he filmed alongside a Minuteman III ICBM, the land leg. Then, Remarkably, he flew in the B-2 Spirit stealth bomber.
The stealth bomber? Wow.
Yeah, became only the 820th person ever to do that, got his official Spirit number, and the final piece, in August, was going aboard the USS Wyoming, a ballistic missile submarine, the Sea Leg.
What was his biggest takeaway from seeing all this up close?
He really emphasized the people, the youth and professionalism of the crews running this incredibly powerful, incredibly dangerous machinery. Many are in their early 20s working in tough, austere conditions.
He shared an anecdote about that, didn't he? Something on the B-52.
Yeah, during his B-52 mission, they had a significant malfunction, intense heat, problems in the cockpit. But the crew handled it with total professionalism, completed the mission, shows the level of training and composure required.
Let's break down those three legs again, ICBMs, bombers, subs. What's the strategic purpose of having all three for deterrence?
It's all about redundancy and ensuring a second strike capability. The ICBMs, the land-based missiles in silos, are sometimes called missile sponges.
Missile sponges, meaning?
Meaning their locations are fixed, they're known. So, in theory, an attacker would have to waste a significant part of their arsenal trying to take them out first, hopefully reducing the number of missiles available for other targets, or for hitting back after a U.S. retaliation.
So they're designed to draw fire, essentially, or survive long enough to launch.
Right. Then you have the bombers, which offer flexibility. And then the submarines, like the USS Wyoming Jamali visited, they are the most survivable leg.
Because they're hidden.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Constantly moving, submerged. Only the captain and the navigator know the sub's exact location. This stealth guarantees that even if a devastating first strike took out land bases and bombers, the subs would survive to launch a retaliatory strike. That assured second strike capability is the bedrock of nuclear deterrence, mutually assured destruction.
Jamali's reflection on standing next to an ICBM really ties back to Bigelow's film, doesn't it?
It does. He talked about that contrast, the sheer power to literally eradicate life face to face with it, and the absolute necessity for logic and restraint to ensure it's never used irrationally. The whole system hangs on that human restraint.
Which, as the film highlights, might be the weakest link. Okay, let's make a big shift now from these existential military questions to domestic policy and its very real, very immediate economic and social impacts, starting with money migration.
Right. This is about a huge surge in remittances money sent home by migrants, and it's driven by fear.
Fear of deportation under the Trump administration's intensified crackdowns.
Exactly. The sources cite over 2 million removals since January, 400,000 actual deportations. That creates this powerful sense of urgency among undocumented workers.
And you can see that urgency in the numbers. Remittances to Latin America are projected to hit $161 billion this year.
Up 8% from 2024. And for some countries, it's even more dramatic. Honduras saw a 25% jump in just the first 8 months of 2025. That money is a vital lifeline for economies there.
Manuel Orozco called it a cashing out mentality.
Yeah, like people feel they're on a deadline. So instead of sending smaller amounts regularly, they're sending larger lump sums. The average payment climbed from around $300 to nearly $400. It's creating this short-term cash injection into those Latin American economies.
And there's a legislative threat adding to the pressure. This One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
Right. It proposes a 1% tax specifically on cash remittances, money orders, cashier's checks.
It's not bank transfers.
No, bank transfers are exempt. But think about it. Many undocumented workers don't have formal bank accounts. They rely on these cash transfer systems. So the tax hits the most vulnerable group hardest, adding another hurdle.
And there's a debate around this, obviously. Republicans arguing the money should stay in the U.S.
Versus the counter-argument from people like Ruby Bledsoe. She points out that these migrants are already contributing massively to the U.S. economy. They pay sales tax, property tax if they rent, often income tax withheld.
And fund programs like Social Security through payroll deductions, even though they can't access those benefits themselves.
Precisely. Bledsoe argues that cutting off remittances, which people back home rely on to survive, could actually backfire. It might increase future migration pressure by making it harder for people to afford to stay in their home countries.
So the policy aimed at reducing migration might inadvertently fuel it by destabilizing neighboring economies.
Wow.
Complex stuff.
Very.
Okay, let's pivot from the movement of money and people to the movement of work. Working from home, WFH, and its unexpected family benefits.
Yeah, this was fascinating. A big study across 38 countries found a clear positive relationship between remote work and, well, having babies, procreation.
Which is highly relevant given the U.S. fertility rate hit that record low of 1.599 in 2024. way below the replacement level.
And the study got specific. It found that when both partners and a couple work from home at least one day a week, their total lifetime fertility increased by 0.18 children in the U.S.
0.18 children. That's a measurable demographic impact just from changing where people work.
It seems so. Nicholas Bloom, the Stanford economist who co-authored it, explained the likely reason. It's not some huge cultural shift. It just makes life easier.
How so?
Easier to manage childcare logistics, doctor's appointments, school runs, dealing with a sick kid quickly. Plus, it saves couples, on average, 1.5 hours of commuting time per day. That's time regained for family, less stress.
And Bloom even put an economic number on it?
He did. He estimated that if the roughly half of Americans whose jobs could be remote actually did it, it could lead to an extra 100,000 babies born per year in the U.S.
Wow. And the economic impact of that?
An estimated $100 billion in extra spending long term. Bloom basically called WFH a potential policy win-win. Free for the government, easy to execute, boosts families and the economy.
But there's a counterargument, of course. Timothy Carney.
Right, from the American Enterprise Institute. He argues, yeah, WFH helps, but the real driver of the baby bust is deeper. It's a cultural shift towards careerism, individualism, putting careers before family.
He points to Nordic countries, right, where even universal childcare hasn't reversed falling birth rates.
Exactly. Suggesting structural fixes like WFH or childcare only go so far if the underlying cultural values haven't prioritized family.
So it's an ongoing debate. Bloom focusing on structural convenience, Carney on deeper cultural values. And this clashes directly with the Trump administration's push for federal workers to return to the office full time.
It does. Carney actually supports WFH for its flexibility, but he contrasts it with that administration mandate demanding a full return to in-person work. His point seems to be you can give people flexibility, but where people's hearts are ultimately determines their choices about family.
You can't mandate wanting kids, essentially. Okay, fascinating stuff. Let's shift gears again, maybe lighten the mood a bit, move into the cultural and commercial landscapes.
Sounds good. How about starting with consumer trends? Newsweek's list of America's best online shops for 2026.
Right. This looks like a pretty thorough analysis. They screened thousands of shops based on nearly 50 criteria, surveyed thousands of shoppers.
Yeah, very rigorous. Looked at things like trust and security, usability, website traffic growth, the stuff that really matters to online shoppers.
And what stands out isn't just who's on top, but maybe why. It seems like specialized retailers often score really highly, sometimes better than the giant general stores.
That's interesting. Like Corel.com and Household Goods scored 8.62, or Hobby.com for arts and crafts got an 8.71.
And RealTruck.com for car parts and accessories got 8.60. It suggests consumers really value that deep expertise and maybe trust in a specific niche.
Specialization builds loyalty? Maybe. Okay, from online shopping, let's dive into something more traditional yet also innovative. Japanese cuisine.
Yes, the sources had some great examples here of blending old and new, like Toshimaya Steak.
Right. A company with a 400-year history, their founder opened the first izakaya ever. But the current president isn't just resting on laurels. They serve traditional dianas, but also created something new, like a Toshimaya butter.
Butter made with segulese.
Yeah, segulese, butter, dried fruit. Taking a traditional byproduct and turning it into a modern gourmet product, that's clever adaptation.
And then there's the high-tech angle. Shutime and their AI baker.
The H-E-O, the AI craftsman. This is wild. They're using AI to essentially digitize the exact techniques and recipes of their master Baumkuchen bakers.
Why? To replace the bakers?
No, more for preservation and replication. It creates this detailed data bank of the master's know-how in the cloud. Protects the intellectual property, but also allows others using the Theo system to reproduce these incredibly complex cakes authentically. AI preserving artistry, it's quite something.
And speaking of authentic replication, TableMark Foods.
The frozen food pioneers. Their Snooki Udon noodles are apparently a world record holder for sales. And the key is they can be ready in just 3 minutes from the microwave.
Making authentic Japanese meals super accessible.
Exactly. But the president, Yusuke Matsuda, stresses they achieve that scale only by strictly following traditional methods to get the flavor right. They're also doing plant-based options now with their Beyond Free brand for inclusivity.
The environment plays a huge role too, doesn't it? Nagai Nori seaweed.
Yeah, located in Aichi, where the mineral-rich rivers apparently give their nori a uniquely superior flavor. The local environment is the key ingredient.
Same for Shimadazono tea in Kagoshima. Volcanic soil, special water.
Right, temperate climate, volcanic soil for good yields. And they've set up an organic biofarm using pristine spring water, partly to educate visitors about sustainable tea growing. It's about connecting people back to the source.
And some companies are trying to take traditional ingredients global in new ways, like Marumatsu Busan and Menma.
Menma, the bamboo shoots usually found in ramen, they see potential beyond the ramen bowl, marketing it based on global health trends. High in fiber, works in vegan ramen, fits that whole wellness market push.
That innovative spirit seems to carry right over into broader corporate strategies in Japan, particularly around sustainability, the corporate marathon idea.
Definitely. Look at ASICS, the sportswear giant. Sustainability is now a core pillar for them.
Why the focus on CO2 reduction specifically?
President Mitsuyuki Tominaga linked it directly to their business. Extreme heat impacts outdoor sports, so climate change is an existential threat to their market. They're focusing upstream, redesigning shoes like the Nimbus Mirai or Gel Light Il CM 1.95 to use fewer components, cutting emissions right at the start of the process.
Smart. And then you have Book Off, the reuse retailer. Their whole model is sustainable.
Inherently. President Yasutaka Horiuchi talked about their mission, just diverting tons and tons of used books, clothes, toys away from landfills. Very community-focused.
And their international brand, Jalan Jalan Japan, is quite clever, too.
Yeah, they use climate differences strategically. Send surplus winter clothes from Japan to colder places like Kazakhstan, summer clothes to warmer places like Malaysia. It ensures items get a second life somewhere rather than just being dumped locally. Really efficient reuse.
There were other interesting tech innovations, too. Basement Factory Design's ultrasonic hair irons.
Care Pro, no heat involved, apparently, uses ultrasonic waves to help hair treatments penetrate better. Salons can offer high-value, damage-free services.
And Pearl Drums, famous for acoustic drums, moving into hybrid digital.
The Emerge series, co-developed with KORG, blending their traditional craftsmanship with modern digital tech for today's musicians.
And Soto Textiles, a 100-year-old company.
Specializing in those deep black formal fabrics, they've adapted by becoming vertically integrated and even launched their own direct-to-consumer brand, MOVB. That helps them stay connected to changing fashion trends while maintaining their niche expertise.
Quite a tour of Japanese innovation. Okay, let's wrap up with the cultural spotlight. Actors talking about challenging roles. Michael J. Fox first, on Back to the Future's 40th anniversary.
Yeah, he shared a great story about meeting Leah Thompson. Remember, he replaced Eric Stoltz mid-shoot. Thompson was initially cranky about it, loyal to Stoltz, and Fox himself was exhausted juggling the movie and his sitcom.
Not a great start. How do they click?
Pure comedy instinct. Fox recalled a scene running towards Thompson's character's bed. The original line was just flat, on the chair.
Boring.
Totally. So Fox suggested Thompson deliver the line that became famous, over there, on my hope chest. That, plus Fox doing this hilarious physical comedy bit, falling off the bed, trying to put his pants on it, just clicked. Thompson saw his skill. They found their chemistry. Improv saved the day.
Classic. Okay, next up, Jason Clarke playing Alex Murdaugh.
A hugely complex role. Clark talked about wanting to find the tragedy of Roman proportions in Murdaugh's story. He refused to just play him as a cartoon bad guy, wanted to really disappear into the character, explore the downfall.
And he's been busy. Also in The Last Frontier, and Catherine Bigelow's A House of Dynamite. Seems drawn to intense stuff.
Definitely gravitates towards high-stakes drama, whether it's true crime, historical, or political thrillers.
And finally, Keira Knightley in The Woman in Cabin 10.
She plays a journalist who witnesses something awful on a yacht, but nobody believes her. That theme of women not believed really resonated with her.
She enjoyed playing the hero, though.
Oh, yeah. She joked about telling a co-star who was running too fast in a scene, "You don't get to catch me because I'm the hero, okay." Just having fun with it.
And she reflected on Bend It Like Beckham, too.
Fondly. But she also noted, kind of surprisingly, that even 20-plus years later, there still hasn't really been another film about women's soccer. Highlights how unique and maybe ahead of its time that movie was.
What a journey through this issue. From, wow, the brink of nuclear war scenarios.
To the immediate tactical headaches of drone incursions hitting NATO.
And then down to these really personal impacts of policy on families sending money home or deciding whether WFH makes having another kid feasible.
You really see this core tension running through everything, don't you? On one hand, these massive external systemic threats, nuclear arsenals, hybrid warfare that seem to demand incredibly complex, high-tech control systems.
Right. Systems we spend trillions on. But then, set right against that, are these deeply internal, fundamental human needs. Financial security for your family back home. Stability. the desire to build a family, maybe have more kids if life feels manageable.
Things that maybe don't require trillions in tech, but perhaps adjustments in how society itself is structured.
Which brings us right to our final provocative thought for you, the listener.
Think about the contrast. Bigelow's film, A House of Dynamite, it really exposes just how fragile human judgment is when faced with that terrifying sole authority over nuclear weapons, and how little practice the decision maker gets.
While, on the other hand, that work-from-home study suggests that a relatively simple structural change, letting people work flexibly, could measurably increase something as fundamental as the birth rate, boosting societal happiness in the economy, potentially at no cost to the government.
So here's the question to leave you with. You've heard about the weaknesses in our most critical defense systems, the ones reliant on flawed human judgment under pressure. And you've heard about society's basic needs and how structural tweaks can support them. Where does true long-term security lie?
Is it in pouring ever more resources into complex military tech and deterrent systems that ultimately hinge on that potentially shaky human element? Or is it perhaps in restructuring our society, our work, our policies to better support fundamental human flourishing, family life, and build stability from the inside out?
Something to think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Thank you.